The views and comments expressed on the Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on the Space Show are primarily for educational purposes.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other thing. Not because they are easy, but
we
because
have main engine start. 4, 3, 2, 1.
It's the Space Show with Dr. David Livingston, broadcasting to 7 continents, consistently bringing you quality news and interviews with the best and brightest minds in the new space economy. Here is the founder and host of the Space Show, the man who best articulates the vision of space commercial enterprise, Dr. David Livingston.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to our Tuesday Space Show program. I am your host, David Livingston. Thank you for tuning in tonight. It's great to be here, and I really am glad all of you are here. It's an absolutely gorgeous night in the San Francisco Bay Area. I hope wherever you are, it is equally as nice. We have a great, interesting, innovative, and very unique discussion planned for you tonight. So let me tell you a little bit about it and introduce our guest to you. But first, if you would like to call us once we get going, the toll-free number is 1-866-687-7223. Remember, there are no call screeners. Do let it ring until I can answer it. We'll bring you up on air as quickly as possible. We do hold callers over the break, and we will answer the phone during the break. So do not let an upcoming break thwart you from using the telephones. That said, if you insist on email, it is drspace@thespaceshow.com. I also urge all of you who might call, do not wait until the last 10 minutes of the show like you usually do. Call us much earlier so that we can have pretty much an on-time program and not be crowded and rushed at the end of the program. So I know you like to call at the last minute, but again, 1-866-687-7223, and we're going to be available and taking calls in just a few minutes. Do visit our website, thespaceshow.com, and at our website you'll find the comprehensive newsletter. It is uploaded Sunday afternoon or Sunday evening. It has all of the details of our week's programming. And it has the full guest bios available. And it also is the only place you're going to find the coming attractions. So if you want to know what's ahead for the Space Show over the next month or two, this is where you need to go check it. Also, if we have to change or modify our schedule or get a special announcement out to you, this is where you'll find those special announcements and those changes before any place else. And again, you can't miss our website newsletter. It's in big letters right on our front page at www.thespaceshow.com. And then if you want to subscribe to our very short email newsletter, that option is right there. You'll see it with a pop-up window, or just send your request to drspace@thespaceshow.com. Everything we do is archived, so you can download shows right off of our website, or you can listen to them on our website. You'll also see a guest search tool on our website. There you can use a global search, and you can search for your favorite guest name to see if they've ever been on the show and when, or your favorite term like space radiation, and then you'll be able to call up all of the dates and programs where those terms of that guest appeared, and then you can use our archives to go access those shows. We're approaching 1,800 shows, and every one of them is available on our website. We have a store up near the top of our website. You'll see it. It's listed as Space Show Gear. Please check it out. And above all, you'll see the Support the Space Show button. And please remember, we're a nonprofit 501c3 with one giant leap foundation.org. And we would appreciate your support. This show needs your support to stay on the air and provide all of the services that we're providing. So donations are welcome. And remember, as a nonprofit, if you're paying federal taxes, you do get a deduction. If you pay California taxes, you also get a deduction. If you have any questions, check it out at onegiantleapfoundation.org or email me at drspace@thespaceshow.com. Do also remember that we're copyrighted and trademarked, and you can download these shows. You do have permission to do that. They are highly compressed MP3s. You can distribute them. And we appreciate your realizing that you can't do anything commercial with these shows. Don't do that. No edits, no private YouTube channels, and written transcripts are not permitted, even for your own use. And we appreciate your support in that. And then do also realize we're podcasting. We thank Andrew at Gigadial.net. They are our podcasting client, and our podcasts are all over the place, iTunes, Microsoft, Zoom, and a host of other places. If you do have any podcasting questions, let me hear from you, and hopefully we can answer them. We do respond to everybody's emails, and we will definitely respond to yours. Finally, remember that The Space Show is brought to you in part by the Secure World Foundation, promoting cooperative solutions for space security. For more information, please do visit their website, secureworldfoundation.org. So tonight we have two guests with us, although I still have to call one of the guests, and I will do that in just a minute. But let me tell you a little bit about both of our guests. So the guest that I'm going to call in just a few minutes is Brian Shiro. Those of you who are frequent Space Show listeners have heard Brian on the show many times before. He is a geophysicist with the National Oceanographic and Atmospheric Administration's Pacific Tsunami Warning Center, which is in Hawaii, and he provides operational expertise with earthquake, seismology, and tsunami warning. In 2010, he was the co-founder of Astronauts for Hire, which you've heard us talk about on this show, which is an organization dedicated to creating the next generation commercial astronaut workforce, right now focused on the suborbital community. Brian has a BA with triple majors in integrated science, geology, and physics from Northwestern University. He has a master's in Earth and Planetary Sciences from Washington U in St. Louis. And he also has a master's in science at Space Studies from the University of North Dakota. He's also attended ISU, and he is a PhD student at the University of Hawaii. And I'm going to dial up Brian in just a minute. But also with us is a gentleman I met at the Suborbital Research Conference back, I guess it was in, it was either February or March. I'm a little bit, I don't remember exactly when it was. God, how horrible. Anyway, I had lunch with this gentleman, and, you know, I thought I was asking him questions that were kind of a little bit out there in left field, and lo and behold, he's doing research on all of this. So I want to introduce to you Dr. Friedman Freund. He is a NASA senior scientist at Ames Research Center in the Earth Science Division. He's also a senior scientist at the Carl Sagan Center at SETI Institute, and as if that's not enough, he's an adjunct physics professor at San Jose State University, which is in San Jose, California, of course. And he has been at NASA Ames Research Center as an NRC senior associate, principal investigator, and scientist. And he has a variety of research interests. And his bio is up on the website, and I would really urge you all to read it. But we started talking about how the sun affects seismic activity, how you can examine earthquakes here on Earth from space. And then I started asking him if the reports I've read about animal behavior and sometimes human behavior is really legitimate in terms of looking at earthquakes, maybe predicting earthquakes. And lo and behold, Dr. Freund has done research on all of this, and in fact, Brian is one of the authors with him on a paper that I picked up at the conference, Measuring Ion Currents and Electric Fields Caused by Earthquakes, Volcanoes, and Lightning in the Mesosphere. So that's why I brought the two of them together. They work together in their areas of research, and this is going to be an interesting topic. We're going to talk about how space is being used in the study of earthquakes, maybe even how it relates to animal behavior with earthquakes and earthquake predictions. Dr. Freund is with us, and I'd like to welcome him to the show now. And while he is giving us a little bit of an introduction to his science and his field, I'll get Brian on the telephone. So welcome to the Space Show, Dr. Freund. Can you kind of give us an introduction and maybe the 101 background into the kind of work you're doing and how space relates to it?
Yeah, I'm happy to do this. Good evening,
David. I'm calling here from the Silicon Valley. I'm with the NASA Ames Research Center, like David Kubitsky said. And I became interested just a little bit more than 10 years ago in studies that relate to the physics underlying earthquakes. Not the way most seismologists are doing the physics of earthquake, which is essentially mechanics, but I was interested in the electrical properties of rocks, because earlier work that I had started way back in the 70s, 80s, in fact in Europe, in Germany, made me aware of the possibility that under certain conditions, rocks that are considered relatively boring insulators can become electrically active. And when I discovered, I studied this for years using temperature, heat, as a driver for these phenomena, until one day I realized that, well, I can stress the rocks and achieve the same electrical phenomena. And that catapulted me into the area of earthquake research, because what the Earth is doing prior to earthquake, it is stressing large volumes of rock 10, 20, 30 kilometers below the surface of the Earth until they eventually will rupture. But during that time, before they rupture, that's where my interest lies.
So, are you doing this with SETI, with NASA, a combination of both?
Yes, a combination of both. I'm working at NASA, and I'm closely working with a lot of people at NASA, but I'm not a government employee, so I have to have another organization, another affiliation. And SETI is one of them. The other is the San Jose State University Physics Department. And SETI Institute came into the picture because the work that actually led me to the discovery that is now centerpiece in earthquake research was actually, I started this in the area of trying to understand conditions on the early Earth before life started. And this origin of life-related work that I undertook from a solid-state physics perspective led me to the discovery of these electrically active defects in crystals that now are centerpiece in my work in earthquakes.
So do you find that the data, the research you need to do these studies, is it, do you almost have to go and create it? Is it readily available? I mean, how do you research something so cutting edge?
It's a long and tedious process. It's not a single aha event, but it's a sequence of aha events when I studied defects in crystals. My background is crystallography, and I have had a lifelong interest in understanding defects in crystals. So that led me to semiconductor physics and similar areas. And as part of this study, I realized that there's one family of defects in oxide materials and in silicate and minerals that has been totally ignored and overlooked by the scientific community. People must have seen the effect of the presence of these defects when they were studying physical properties of rock, but they misassigned these phenomena and put them in the wrong pocket, saying, oh, this is all kind of quote-unquote dirt, and we don't have to worry about it. And I realized that, in fact, what these people considered unimportant and a kind of dirt effect was actually a very, very fascinating property of crystals that can be only understood if you do it from a solid-state physics perspective. And that led me to the discovery of this family of defects, which, now jumping 10, 20 years of research, create enormous electric currents deep into Earth's crust when the rocks are being stressed. And that is an amazing correlation.
Absolutely. I believe Brian is with us now. Brian, can you hear us?
Yes, I can. Hi, David.
Hi, and welcome. And we've been sort of doing the 101 introduction to what Dr. Freund does and the type of research he does and some of the correlations. As a NOAA person and a geophysicist, how do you fit into the work that Dr. Freund does? I mean, you're very familiar with it, so you really haven't missed much from our discussion at this point because you know the work so well.
Yeah, thanks for having me on the show, David. And I was actually listening,
okay.
So I didn't miss anything. And good opportunity to be here to talk about this work. And you know, I'm involved with this because I see the potential for really revolutionizing the whole field of geophysical hazard, earthquakes, and even volcanoes. How we detect them and how we can save lives and property, perhaps in the long run. And because one of the most tantalizing aspects of these electrical phenomena that Friedman was outlining is that they're precursory in many cases to the main event by several days and or even longer in some cases. And I guess we'll get into it later in the show what that means, but the possibilities for perhaps warning are evident. And now I should note that it's not part of my official job to do this, you know. So I'm interested in this on the side, you know, as an exterior kind of activity right now. But it's, you know, certainly something that's relevant to my work.
Is NOAA interested in this kind of work, or are you a unique animal within NOAA?
Oh, I'm kind of a unique animal, but I think NOAA is certainly interested in improving its tsunami warning system in which I'm embedded. So, and we're always looking for ways to increase our abilities and decrease our warning times. So currently that system is purely on traditional seismology, which is really what I'm trained in. And, you know, in which you have to detect the earthquake at a number of land-based stations. And after you detect the earthquake, then you have to, you know, determine its magnitude and so forth. And then, and just as a proxy, use that to estimate what the hazard might be. So what would be wonderful is if we could have direct measurements of some of these things over an area. And, you know, some space-based system in the future may have that ability.
Gentlemen, what do our space-based systems that are deployed and operating right now, what do they do for you with detecting seismic activity on Earth or monitoring it or helping you? What do we have for space resources that you can tie into and tap into? Friedman, can you give us an idea of what's up there that
yes.
You can use?
It essentially breaks down into two areas. One is core seismic events. When the Earth ruptures over a long fault and the seismic waves are propagating, or a tsunami is propagating through the ocean. This creates a pressure wave, an air pressure wave that propagates upwards, and as it reaches higher and higher altitudes and the air pressure becomes smaller and smaller, the amplitude of this wave becomes larger and larger. And by the time it arrives at the bottom of the ionosphere, these waves have amplitudes of several hundred, if not thousands, of meters. And they modify the distribution of the electrons and ions in the ionosphere, and that can be measured by a number of processes, for instance, by looking at the total electron concentration as a function of time. And when they do this, they see actually when the tsunami is racing over the ocean, they see a wave racing along in the ionosphere. But that are phenomena that happen after the earthquake has occurred. And then there is a completely different group of people that are looking at precursory phenomena that Brian mentioned that arise, that can be observed days, sometimes 10 days or several weeks before earthquakes. And they are much more subtle, and they involve ultra-low frequency electromagnetic waves that travel through the ionosphere, or also a perturbation in the ionosphere where the electrons in the lower edge of the ionosphere are actually coming down 10 to 20 kilometers. They are, the electrons are being pulled down while the positive ions stay higher up. So there is a polarization at the bottom of the ionosphere, which can be clearly detected from ground, particularly at night when the effect of the UV irradiation from the sun is dying away. And that is a different area of research.
Do we have specific satellites that pick this up, or how is the monitoring done?
Yeah, the best satellite that was launched by the French in, I don't remember when it was exactly, I think in 2007 or 6, it was called Demeter, the name of a Greek goddess, and it stopped operating, I think, in the fall, October or November a year ago, so now about 16, 18 months ago. And this was specifically designed to detect these low electric field variations, these ultra-low frequencies in the ionosphere, the electric field distribution in the ionosphere. When the Demeter satellite was crossing over an area where then, a few days later, an earthquake would happen. So they analyzed over a period of 7 or 8 years, they analyzed close to 10,000 earthquakes larger than magnitude 5 around the globe, and they have a fantastic data set of these phenomena that are statistically relevant.
And if I may add one thing, David.
Yes.
The Demeter satellite that Friedman highlighted, as well as some other examples, provide tantalizing, you know, clues to these phenomena. But these are, you know, in the sense that they can monitor the whole 24/7. Their research, at the research the development, you know, they have to be in the right place at the right time to see these things, for the most part. So there is no operational system measuring these phenomena. I should point that out in the sense that it's, you know, there to, you know, with the purpose of protecting people. You know, so after the fact is when most of this analysis is happening. So the only real space-based assets that are used today are just for communications to get data moved around from land-based stations.
Yes, correct.
Mm-hmm. So it's hit and miss if one of these satellites were to catch something real-time, correct?
Yes. Because a satellite passes over at a very high speed and takes only minutes to go from horizon to horizon, and it passes, if you are lucky, it passes over a given spot on the Earth once every 16 days or so. It's hit and miss. And then what Brian alerted to is that you can, of course, also study the ionosphere from the bottom up, looking up, and that is what radio stations are doing when they emit radio frequency signals that are reflected at the ionosphere and transmitted in this way around the globe. When the reflector of the ionosphere changes altitude and changes constitution, changes concentration of the plasma density, that is noticeable in the way radio waves are transmitted. And that can be also used as a diagnostic tool. And for a given installation, that would be available constantly, 24/7.
Let me throw in some questions I got in advance of the show from a young lady in Manhattan, Emma in Manhattan, because this is actually a bit relevant now to our discussion in terms of monitoring the Earth using space resources and satellites. So one of the questions Emma wanted to know is, can you actually see Earth movement from space using satellites? Either of you.
You mean the entire planet moving?
No, I guess if you could you actually see a fault line moving or something like that happening if you happen to be overhead real time when an earthquake happened? Could a satellite pick up that movement?
Absolutely. And some of the work before I joined NOAA dealt with that, where there's a whole field of study called geodesy, which today is largely space-based, and which means you use a satellite was something called synthetic aperture radar to look at the active processes going on the surface of the Earth. And today, these tools have really gone from their infancy about 20 years ago to being nearly real-time operational systems that are used by seismologists.
Brian, you're cutting out. I may try to, when we have the break, call you on one of the landline numbers, but we'll see.
Yeah.
Another question.
I could add to this.
Yes,
David.
Please do, Friedman.
That in addition to the synthetic aperture radar that actually creates a map of the Earth where the height, the topography of the Earth is very accurately measured. So if you then fly over the same area before an earthquake and after an earthquake, and then you subtract the two maps, you actually get a kind of almost like an interference pattern of changes in the topography of the surface of the Earth. And that is done with these satellites, synthetic aperture radar satellites, each time when there is a land-based earthquake. But then in addition, I should point out there's also the GPS technology. And that is, the GPS satellites are sending very accurate signals as they fly around the Earth, and there are many of them. And as these signals pass through the ionosphere, they are suffering refraction, I mean change in the direction of their travel, and also shift in their phase. And these two components have to be corrected for GPS to work properly. So if you are sitting in your car and you want to know where you are within, let's say, 10, 20 meters, then you're calling up a map that is linked to these GPS satellites, and they will give you your exact location. Behind this exact location is correction for these phase shift and refraction effects in the ionosphere. But these corrections, which is kind of unwanted noise for the GPS people, is information for the ionospheric physicists. So they can use this in order to study then the ionosphere. It's a very interesting synergy between two disciplines that were not planned ahead of time. They found it out after they started and developed the GPS satellite fleet.
Interesting. Emma wanted to know also, can any equipment in space or on Earth actually be used in predicting earthquakes yet? And if so, is one source of equipment in space or Earth more useful and more accurate from the other, or are we really a long ways away from predicting an earthquake?
I think I can answer this question because, first of all, the word prediction always conveys the feeling that you can accurately say when something happens, and that will never be the case because the Earth is so complicated, and deep down there where the stresses are building up, things can happen that are unforeseeable. So therefore, I personally always want to use the word forecast, like in meteorology, that the weather is being forecast. You cannot exactly predict where a tornado or where a lightning strike will hit. So having said this, There is really a lot of evidence that we are approaching the possibility of forecasting earthquakes. To recognize conditions where deep in the earth stresses are building up to a level that is likely to lead to an earthquake rupture. But we are still very far away in terms of implementing this in reality. And one of the reasons is that mainstream science has not yet really come around and provided funding for all the work that is being done in this area of electric phenomena prior to earthquakes.
Can space-based resources be used to detect these stresses and then somehow be turned into forecasting, or is this mostly done with earth-based equipment?
The best, of course, would be the combination of both. But like Brian said, a satellite, of course, has the advantage of being able to give a global coverage. And if you have a fleet of satellites, you might overcome that handicap that you need to be at a certain time at a certain place. If you have 10, 20 or more satellites, you will always have a relatively good coverage of every point of the Earth. Yes, these, by looking at the ionosphere and how the ionosphere is being influenced by processes that happen deep in the Earth, you can actually build a system that is likely to provide a relatively good high level of forecast probability for coming earthquakes.
If I may add,
yes,
David, today we're able to forecast pretty accurately where earthquakes will occur. We just don't know when. And the way we know where is based on study of past earthquakes, studies of the stress in the lithosphere in different regions, and part of that is informed by satellite observations, constrained by GPS, for example. And this helps us get an idea of what forces are imposed on the crust in each local region, and therefore how likely that area may be to experience an earthquake. But it's all done in a very probabilistic sense. So that knowing where something's going to happen in the next 100 years or 400 years, we can say that, but knowing when exactly is the hard part. And I think that's where the solid earth monitoring really ends. We need to start looking at these electronic methods that Friedman was explaining, that looking at the emissions that might come from the rocks. But some combination of the two is probably the best. And there are ground-based systems today. For example, there's a company called QuakeFinder that is trying to create a ground-based system to monitor on the west coast of the U.S.
And in Peru. They are building up in Peru and now in Taiwan and in European countries in Greece.
Okay, but guys, Friedman and I live in the Bay Area, so, you know, it doesn't take, you know, your science to say sometime in the future the Bay Area is going to get hit with another big, humongous earthquake. Okay, you know, anyone who has studied history in California knows that this area gets hit by earthquakes. What we want to know is when, and is it going to be in San Francisco or Hollister, or where is it going to be? And we're not there yet. Is that what you're telling me?
Yes.
Yes.
Now,
yes.
If you had, this is really la-la land here, if you had an unrestrained budget and you knew how to appropriately spend the money, which, of course, is key, so that you're not wasting it on, you know, stuff, could you actually say within a decade, say Hollister is going to get an earthquake in 2025 on June 5th?
Plus minus 3 days.
Plus or minus, why the 3 days?
Now, that's again, I hate to be a little bit long-winded, but somehow phenomena that happen down deep in the earth, 10, 20 kilometers down, need to come to reach the surface of the earth, then have an effect on the atmosphere. This effect has to move upward through the atmosphere into the stratosphere, mesosphere, and reach the ionosphere. And these processes typically begin in such a way when stresses are very high that we start to see them, let's say, about a week before. Then we see over a period of 2-3 days an increase of certain anomalies across the entire atmospheric column. Then on the last day before the earthquake, often these phenomena kind of die away. It's like the quiet before the storm. And then the earthquake, a earthquake typically hits. And that is where the uncertainty lies, that first of all, we don't know exactly when, within a number of days, maybe 2-3 days, but also stresses that build up deep below may be accommodated by the Earth in a way that does not include a rupture that would create earthquakes, but what people call a silent earthquake, where actually portions of the Earth's crust are sliding past each other over hours or days, sometimes a week. This happens near Seattle all the time. Every few years or so, there is a big sliding event of the Earth's crust relative to another portion of the Earth's crust that would otherwise be associated with a magnitude 7 earthquake, but there's no earthquake, it's a silent earthquake. But the stresses that drive these phenomena would be the same even in an area where earthquakes can happen. So that is where what Brian meant by saying we know where earthquakes happen.
Right. In fact,
but we just had
a silent earthquake like that in Hawaii last week. If it had happened all at once, it would have been a magnitude 6.5 perhaps, but it was silent, and so there were no seismic waves, so nobody felt it.
Oh, really?
So if there's no seismic waves, how do you know it happened?
Because we can tell the motion through other means. So in this case, we see deformation with GPS measurements. In this case, it also affected the activity of the volcano. And there were several small little tremors associated with it, too, which helped give you a clue that something's going on.
Bob is in San Diego, and he says, very interesting discussion. So just to be clear, and given that I'm not a scientist, it seems to me that the key to all of this takes place in the ionosphere more than any other part of the atmosphere. Is that correct?
Not quite. I think the process really starts from deep below, but then there are very important processes happening at the surface of the Earth, and that is part of the work that I have done. We published way back in the mid-80s, we published a paper that predicted that if these electronic charge pairs are being activated, then we should observe ionization of the air at the air-to-ground interface. And a few years ago, here at Ames, we set up an experiment to test this prediction, and indeed, we observed exactly that the air at the surface of the rock in the laboratory and presumably at the surface of the Earth becomes very heavily ionized. And then these ions are the ones that propagate upwards and have an influence on the ionosphere. And that's why where the ground station idea comes, we now have this network that Brian was mentioning by QuakeFinder, which is actually a private company that provides this service out of the goodness of their heart, funded by another private company. They have now something like 90 to close to 100 ground stations all across California and along the shore in Peru, monitoring both electromagnetic waves and air ionization. And the two parameters together give us a huge amount of information, which then also sheds light on what we see at the same time with ionospheric perturbations with satellite technology. So ground station and satellite technology goes together.
Fascinating.
Yeah, and one of the other effects of the air ionization at the surface sometimes is there are phenomena called earthquake lights that have been recorded throughout human history, and they happened around the time and location of a lot of major earthquakes. Most recently, one of the famous examples was the L'Aquila, Italy earthquake a few years ago, where there were videos and photos taken of all these lights, which might be a result of this ionization. And also, a lot of large earthquakes, including last year's large Tohoku, Japan earthquake, which created a big tsunami, had a very large thermal anomaly. So the area around the fault, just above the surface, was heated up. So is that due to the ionization? You know, so there are a lot of questions, not only in the ionosphere, but also stretching down to the surface.
Where do you think this technology might be in 10 years from now or 15 years from now? Can you imagine the advancements in it and the advancements in this science and discipline for both Earth-based as well as space-based? Is it going to be radically different, and is this field going to radically change before our eyes in a decade or so?
Well, it all depends on the funding, whether the mainstream science, and particularly our colleagues in the area of seismology, would agree to provide funding for this kind of research that is dedicated to pre-earthquake signals rather than looking at the earthquakes themselves and do, like Brian said, a probabilistic analysis of past earthquakes. So we want to catch the earthquake as the stresses are building up in the Earth crust and do this by electrical means. So if this gets funded and we would be able to combine ground stations and satellite technologies, I would say in 5 to 10 years we can really have a revolution in this area.
So what are the challenges in the funding? Is it aside from the fact that the country's broke and money's tight all the way around, is it because there are other projects that have a higher priority in terms of the peer review process, or where do the challenges come in the funding? Are you on the edge of being cutting edge and out of the box? Help me to understand where the funding roadblocks lie.
To traditional seismologists, you know, operating on the inside, you know, I could probably claim that I fall in that group. This is considered outside the box. And now the people who control the funding and the people who control the peer review process are also inside that system. And unfortunately, there was one thing they always point to when projects like this are proposed is an experiment called the Parkfield experiment, which the United States Geological Survey, the USGS, performed in the early 90s. They poured a lot of resources into trying to detect earthquake precursors electrically, you know, as well as through other means, in the California area. And they deemed the project a failure. And there were some, you know, marginal claims of success that were never fully accepted by the community. It was deemed a failure. And so ever since then, the whole field of precursory research has been given this bad name. And so there's an uphill battle culturally within, you know, the status quo to have a change in favor of this kind of work.
Yes, I could add that actually, unfortunately, the Parkfield location appears to be uniquely bad for catching the precursors of stress buildup, probably because there's so much water on one side deep in the underground that kind of quenches away some of the electrical phenomena that could otherwise develop. But there are, therefore, like Brian said, because this was a very high-profile USGS project and tens of millions of dollars were dedicated to this effort over a period of 20 years, the fact that it did not produce any striking results was really very unfortunate.
Now, what was the name of the project again?
Parkfield. Parkfield is the name of a small place, a few houses down in south of Gilroy, here in Northern California.
Okay. Gentlemen, we're going to take our first break. We're halfway through the program. When we come back, I'd like to ask you both about how human and animal behavior correlates into some of this scientific and factual analysis that you're able to do and use and put together. You know, it almost seems like, you know, vinegar and oil or something. But we'll be back in 3 minutes, everybody, and stay tuned. We'll take more of your email questions. And remember, if you would like to call us, and our toll-free line is available, and we do make it available during the break as well, 1-866-687-7223. We'll be back in 3 minutes.
The Space Show thanks its listeners for their generous support. The Space Show now joins forces with the One Giant Leap Foundation to further advance space education and the establishment of a spacefaring society and culture in America and the world. One Giant Leap Foundation is a tax-exempt organization with the purpose of advancing space education and development along with The Space Show. Your support of The Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation helps get the word out as to why space is so essential and important to us all. So join with us by going to www.thespaceshow.com and clicking on the Support The Space Show button. Your contribution will help The Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation in continuing its work and bringing you the programming you want free of charge on a continued basis. And remember, your gift to The Space Show is tax deductible.
I'm Dr. David Livingston, creator and host of The Space Show, and I would like to share my vision with you for not only this radio program, but for space development. Space should be like any other place we choose to visit, work in, or call our home. It should be just another destination, like Tahiti, Hawaii, or any place available to us right now on Earth. When this vision becomes reality, we will be spacefaring in our culture, our economy, our society, and in our lives. Our world will be vastly improved by countless space-related benefits, transforming our lives both in space and right here on Earth. And The Space Show is helping to make this vision a global reality. And welcome back, everybody. This is the second part of our Space Show program today. We're talking with Brian Shiro, Dr. Friedman Freund, and we're talking about earthquakes and space and using space as well as Earth resources for forecasting, measuring, and analysis. So you were at the suborbital conference because you see opportunities for research in using these suborbital vehicles, which hopefully come online soon, and hopefully they do materialize at affordable cost rather than what has been the case in the past. What kind of research, what can you do along the lines of what we've been talking about with the suborbital community? Do one of you want to address that?
Sure, I guess I could start, and Freeman, please add anything to this, but yeah, the suborbital vehicles, as you know, are going to be online within a year or two, we hope, and they're going to provide exciting opportunities for research in a number of fields. One of those fields, of course, is access to that environment of the atmosphere that, to this point, we haven't had a lot of access to, other than with sounding rockets, which just kind of quickly go up and down and don't spend a whole lot of time there. So with suborbital vehicles spinning the apex of the trajectory through the upper mesosphere, you get 4 or 5 minutes there where you can really study the region. And so the mesosphere is one of the key areas in this equation of the coupling of ionization from the surface up into the ionosphere. And what we want to do is understand how that process works in measuring the electric fields, ion concentrations, and those kinds of things, because if we could develop a payload of some kind that measures these things reliably, perhaps it could become a regular fixture on these suborbital vehicles to amass more data. Perhaps it'll add to our understanding of ground-based measurements or satellite-based measurements, just improve the accuracy of those readings. So I'm excited by the possibilities to advance this science.
Do you think the suborbital price range is a big factor, or is it just the availability of having access that's a bigger factor, or both of them play a role in this, Brian?
Well, I think both, of course, play a role. I mean, cost is important, but in the grand scheme of things, the cost of a ticket to suborbital space is much less than the cost of your own sounding rocket launch, for example. So in that sense, it's more affordable, and it has the advantage of having a faster turnaround time as well. In theory, you could fly several times a week, depending on how fast they turn around the vehicles. And another advantage, at least of some of the suborbital companies, is that they can fly from different spaceports. And hopefully, eventually, we'll have point-to-point transport all over the planet. That's what we all hope for. But some companies like X-Corps are advertising the ability to fly their Lynx space plane to different spaceports, which has the advantage of you might want to get close to a seismically active area or a volcano or something that's of interest that might be generating these ions and fly over it. And so I think that's one of the scenarios that we're going to consider.
Interesting. Friedman, any comments on the suborbital community and market that may be opening up?
Oh, yes. I truly agree fully with what Brian says, and maybe I can add a little bit from the new science that is coming out of the work that I'm doing, and that is, I mentioned before that when stresses build up deep in the Earth, the air becomes ionized at the surface of the Earth over an area tens of, sometimes 100 miles across. And then you create a bubble of air that is heavily laden with ions, and all these ions have only the positive sign, so they are positively charged air ions. And these move up through the atmosphere, into the stratosphere, and we predict that they will continue to drift upwards through the mesosphere, which is already almost near vacuum. It's not perfect enough vacuum for satellites to fly, but it's already such an advanced vacuum that airplanes and so on can no longer fly. So in this region of the mesosphere, which is about 60 kilometers, so 50 to 100 kilometers in extent, there processes happen that are only coming into focus right now, and that would include, for instance, lightning in the mesosphere, similar to the sprites that happen over thunderstorm systems. But these lightning would happen over regions where earthquakes might be brewing deep in the Earth's crust.
Really? So you can correlate the lightning possibly with stresses for the Earth and a possible earthquake?
Yes, because the lightning at this very high altitude, the lightning strikes are very short, just like the sprites in over thunderstorm system. They are only kind of fraction of a millisecond long lightning strikes. They have a very distinct frequency spectrum. They also have we have evidence of such lightnings having been photographed from the ground. When there was an earthquake coming up, and indicators showing towards the New Zealand, a gentleman in Australia set up a camera at night taking pictures, long-time exposure in the direction of New Zealand, and then suddenly he caught on film a period of time where at a distance of over 1,000 kilometers away, the sky was lighting up. So these are phenomena that could be, they're totally not yet understood and not yet studied. They're just predicted on the basis of these ionization processes that happen on the surface of the Earth and the upward drift of these ions.
Is the mainstream or the more traditional disciplines that we talked about a few minutes ago and before the break, are they as interested and do they see as many opportunities with the suborbital emerging industry as you guys do, or is this still a bit on the out-of-the-box side?
Well, Brian did say that it is out-of-the-box side, and also I would agree fully because the community of people that is interested in lightning in the mesosphere is completely different. They have no interest in seismology. And the seismology, on the contrary, seismologists, on the contrary, have relatively little understanding and knowledge and do not seek to understand and know about processes that happen in the ionosphere or the mesosphere.
So you guys need to talk to each other.
Yes, yes, that is.
So you mentioned during the break that you were at a recent meeting, Friedman, I believe you said USC, where there was actually some movement and some communication between the out-of-the-box types as well as the more mainstream. Is that correct?
Yes.
Tell us about that.
Well, there is a very well-renowned and very highly respected organization. It's called the Southern California Earthquake Center, SCEC. And it has been run for a number of years by a very smart and very broadly interested seismologist by name Tom Jordan. And Tom Jordan came a few times over the course of a few years to poster sessions and to talks that we presented at, for instance, the AGU meeting in December in San Francisco. And he eventually came around and he said, well, you guys, you have something that looks very, very interesting. We, seismologists, should really listen to you. So he asked me and Tom Bleier from the company, from QuakeFinder, to organize a workshop which took place last July. And for the first time really in decades, representatives from this outside, the seismology community and very much mainstream seismologists were sitting together for two or three days, and we were discussing these very issues.
Progress made?
I think so. It's the first time that we were actually talking to each other, and actually today, and we have done joint experiments with one of our main critiques from the area of USGS, and he came to NASA, and we are doing joint experiments together in order to kind of understand how we can really communicate and how the things that we are doing, we do them differently than what the mainstream seismologists are doing, and how we can understand and find a common language to talk about.
Let's take a look at what's not, well, maybe it is scientific, but a different scientific, the, you know, people's behavior and animals' behavior in and around these stresses and maybe being able to give us a clue of an earthquake. So there is legitimacy to this, correct?
May I answer this question again? Sorry, Brian, I don't want to take your time away, but the animal behavior is very much on my mind in recent months, and I definitely think that we are close to even understanding what is happening, what is driving animals to react in specific ways.
I should note that with a lot of the major earthquakes that have happened, like, for example, the 2004 Sumatra earthquake, the second or third largest earthquake ever, there were many, many anecdotes of animals, like elephants, for example, and other large mammals, running away from the shore. to escape from the supposed coming tsunami.
And, you mean big animals? We're not talking about dogs and cats now.
Well, dogs and cats too, actually. But in fact, the Chinese, for example, study this a lot more seriously than the Americans. But it's something, as do the Russians, I should say. But it's something that has been looked at for a long time, and there is a lot of anecdotal evidence of this. And the traditional thinking is that they're detecting infrasonic or infrasound waves, which are measurable with normal microphones, and which are happen after the earthquake. However, one tantalizing idea is that perhaps some of them, at least, are also detecting ionization, which might be even before the event.
Brian, does NOAA put any effort or research or resources into any of this?
Oh, no. Not like this.
It's not even on the board.
No, it's not.
What about if you wanted to get to put in a study and get funded by one of the government funding agencies? Could you do so? Would this get through peer review?
I doubt it. It would be difficult. I think one can create a rigorous study for this, of course, and perhaps in the laboratory. For example, Friedman has shown in the laboratory that he can squeeze rocks and stress them and create these kinds of electric fields and ionization. You know, but maybe you could put some animals, some rats or something on top of it and see what they do. Maybe something like that would happen, but it would be difficult to do a large-scale field study on this in a controlled way, I think. But maybe this is another community we need to engage, is the biological community, that the wildlife biologists and people like that who track populations and migrations and, they might have something to say about it.
What about marine mammals like whales and dolphins? Has anybody, Friedman, has any research been shown what they do in an area that gets an earthquake or maybe an upcoming tsunami?
Yes, well, the evidence that is being reported is always called anecdotal, which often has the connotation that it is not totally reliable. But one of the things that, again, when we started with our work on generating electric current when we squeeze the rocks, we also asked the question, what happens if these electric currents that are flowing, and sometimes these currents are thousands, hundred thousands, maybe millions of amperes strong, what happens when these currents flow into water? So again, at NASA Ames, we set up experiments and showed that when these currents flow from the ground into the water, either at the bottom of the ocean or at the bottom of a lake, they oxidize the water to hydrogen peroxide. And therefore, now suddenly we are faced with yet another aspect, namely that is electrochemistry that is happening as a result of these electric phenomena that are generated by stress or activated by stress. And it is quite possible that some marine or aquatic animals or semi-aquatic animals like amphibians, frogs, and so on would react to these chemical clues rather than to vibration and other physical indicators.
And there are some, after the earthquake has happened, there are something called T phases or T waves that are generated, which travel through the water. And they're collimated in the SOFAR channel, which is the same area that, for example, submarines use for communication. And these things are well known, these types of seismic waves are well known for affecting the hearing of whales and dolphins. So that's a physical means, which is after the event, but at least we know they do detect that.
And before the event, there is one tantalizing idea, and that is these ultra-low frequency emissions that I was mentioning before, which particularly the QuakeFinder stations are monitoring along the San Andreas Fault in Peru. These waves occur at the same frequency range in which our brain waves, or the brain waves of all mammals, are active. And therefore, there is a possibility that if our brain waves are inundated by external ultra-low frequency electromagnetic waves that interfere with our brain waves, our behavior would be affected.
Is there any correlation to human behavior being affected in an area where an earthquake hits?
I'm in touch with a university professor in Siberia, in Russia, who did a wonderful, excellent study around the time when a big earthquake, 7.6 magnitude earthquake, hit a rather rural area in southern Siberia. And he was able to show, just going into the medical records that is held by the state and published by the state, he was able to show that about 12 to 14 days before the earthquake, the number of people flooding to emergency rooms suddenly started to increase, and all their conditions for which they sought medical help were conditions that point to functioning of the brain.
Fascinating.
The people that were already epileptic were sensitive to epileptic seizures. They came in increased numbers to the medical community asking for help because they did not understand what was happening to them. And then 10 days later or so, the earthquake hit. And then this spike of people seeking medical help went back to normal. So there is a correlation, yes. But it's still very tenuous, and there's no funding available so far to study these processes.
I don't know. It would seem to me, given the damage that is caused by these major events, if we just look at what happened in Japan last year, that research dollars would flow to these fields because it's got to be cheaper to do the research than to deal with the tragedy and the claims and the rebuilding. You know, afterwards, I would even think insurance companies would want to help sponsor and fund research. That's got to be a lower cost item to them than all the claims for rebuilding after, you know, one of these major tragedies.
Yeah.
But I guess that's not the case, is it?
Well, one thing, of course, is that if you would know that an earthquake will come, this is important to save lives. But it will not necessarily, at least not in a very on a large scale, help you prevent damage, because the buildings will anyhow collapse. But you can maybe prevent people from being killed.
Yeah, so the buildings are not going to be evacuated, the people are.
Right.
Right. In the case of Japan, the even though that was a tremendously energetic, large earthquake, very few buildings suffered significant damage because of their excellent building codes. And just contrast that with, you know, the Haiti earthquake a few years ago, with, in which they have almost no building codes, and it was total destruction, even though the Haiti earthquake was rather small by comparison. So the building codes and engineering community, that makes all the difference for the buildings. But as far as lives go, it's all about knowledge, education, culture, procedures, you know, the sorts of things that you can change, luckily. So that's why I have a lot of hope that you know, combination of early warning systems as they evolve today, as well as these new things we're talking about, could help save lives.
Mm-hmm.
If that Japan earthquake had happened in Los Angeles or San Francisco, would our engineering and construction have been up to it, or would we have suffered worse than Japan?
Worse.
Probably worse, yeah. I agree.
And that's because our codes are not as rigorous, or what?
Yeah, I think that's it. And you know, the culture of the U.S. is a lot more laissez-faire about this kind of thing. And in Japan, they do drills, earthquake and tsunami drills, all the time involving the entire populace. And so everyone knows what to do. And so, you know, we don't do that in the U.S. It's just not part of the culture in the U.S. Now, the emergency management community itself stays on its toes, and it's really good. But taking that to the next level, to the public, is something that just doesn't happen in this country very often.
But to come back to your question, David, whether it would be reasonable to invest some modest amount of money to prevent a small fraction of the cost that would incur by it. This is really illustrated by a study that was published 2 years ago and a year ago for Northern California here for the Haywood Fault on the that runs through Berkeley, and now more recently for Southern California, from the Office of Bureau of Labor, a government agency. And they looked just at the cost to the government in lost income and taxes if a magnitude 7 earthquake or 6.9 earthquake would hit the San Francisco Bay Area. And they come up with a value of on the order of $165 billion. And that's not counting the damage and the loss of life.
So that's just the loss of
just the economic loss.
Economic loss, but not the damage.
Yeah. So what I'm sometimes saying to my friends on the other side, say, well, if we could save 1% of these, if we can lower the cost by 1%, take 1% of $160 billion, makes $1.6 billion.
Right.
We would be happy to get a fraction of a per mil of this for funding research. It would be wonderful. And we would, in 5 or 10 years, be able to really make tremendous progress.
This is Joe in Tucson, Arizona, has this question. You've spent most of the program talking about analysis, forecasting, predictions, that type of thing. Is there any hope of stopping one if you were able to accurately predict or forecast that one was about to start? Can you actually interfere or mitigate somehow or lighten the effect of it?
Brian, what would you say?
I don't think so. I think that would be... It would make for a great science fiction movie, but I just don't see how we could stop the mammoth forces in the Earth from operating. Plate tectonics, which is what drives all of this, is always churning, and you know it's the weight of the continents subducting and pushing on each other that's driving the whole process due to the heat of the Earth trying to escape. This is a very major Earth system that just can't be tampered with. So, you know. Having said that, there is a project right now, which is part of EarthScope, which is the only, only Earth science project that's ever been funded at the level equivalent to the Hubble Telescope, for example. It's a major congressional line item. And part of the EarthScope project is to understand the North American continent, but another part of it is to drill deep down in the San Andreas Fault itself and measure all kinds of properties of the fault to understand it better. One of the ideas is that, and one of the things they're measuring are, you know, water flow, fluid flow, ions, that kind of thing. Some people think if you can alleviate some of that pressure by drilling, that maybe it'll help. After all, we appear to be able to create earthquakes with fracking, which has been in the news a lot lately. So one would think that perhaps you could do the opposite. But my bet is on not being able to stop the Earth. I'd bet on the Earth anytime.
Also, it comes simply from the reason that the rupture of major earthquakes happens anywhere between, let's say, 7 to 35 kilometers. That's where 85% of the earthquakes happen. And in this region, this is so deep, you cannot reasonably drill down there. The deepest hole that was ever drilled by the Russians, starting already in Soviet time, is 12,000 meters, which is very, very deep.
Yeah, it's about 37,000 feet.
Right. So, and that takes decades to drill. So if we drill like now they do, like Brian mentioned, the EarthScope, drill into the San Andreas Fault, this is very, very interesting from a scientific perspective. But we can only drill, or they can only drill a couple of thousand meters, maybe 2 or 3 kilometers into. And that is by a factor of 5 or 10 less than where the earthquakes are really happening. And we cannot affect these processes. They're just too large.
Our friend Emma in Manhattan says, what about earthquakes in other parts of the solar system like Mars? Are they at all similar to what happens on Earth? Can we learn anything from an earthquake on Mars or someplace else in the solar system that might be useful for what's going on here on Earth?
This is something that I've been pursuing for well over a decade, is trying to understand seismic processes on other planets, and Mars in particular, very close to my heart. And so I really appreciate the question, but unfortunately, we know very little about Mars quakes. And there were seismometers on the Viking landers in the late 1970s, but due to various non-scientific reasons, the seismometers are placed on the high end of those landers, not on the ground at the bottom. And you know, and so what they ended up being were really good wind detectors. The winds on Mars are fairly strong, and the craft was pretty tall, and it would sway in the wind, and that's what they picked up. So we've never measured a Mars quake, and we have measured a lot of moon quakes, though, and we would expect some of the properties on Mars to be similar. And what we know from the moon quakes is that, the moon is very, very dry, has no water, unlike the Earth, and what that does to the rock is it makes the rock extremely efficient at transmitting seismic waves. And so when these moonquakes happen, the energy reverberates very well throughout the rock. It's a phenomenon we don't have on the Earth, where the energy is dissipated much more quickly in the Earth. And one thing I hope will be a regular fixture of any planetary mission, including those to asteroids, is a seismic exploration of the planet. And because really seismology is the best way to determine the interior properties of any planet that you're on. That's how we know the Earth has a core and a mantle and et cetera. It's through seismology. And if we're ever to learn anything about the interior of Mars, it's going to be mostly through seismology. And we can learn a lot about bulk properties from orbiting satellites. And we do know some things. We do have some constraints on its core size, for example, from moment of inertia measurements. But we'll never really know for sure unless we measure directly with seismic waves. And moreover, shallow seismic study, which is something that was also done in Apollo on the Moon by Jack Smith on Apollo 17. If we do that on Mars, this is something astronauts could do, it would be one way to look for water, because water and other resources that are in the shallow few hundred meters of the subsurface are readily detectable with seismic means. So I think there's going to be a big place for that in our future planetary exploration.
So many of us, and I'm going to confess here to my ignorance, have been under the understanding, or maybe the illusion, that we have good seismic information about the solid planets in our solar system, Venus, Mars, going on out, some of the moons. That is simply not true then, right?
That's right. The only two places we've studied seismically are the Earth and the Moon, with the exception of the Sun, because there's something called helioseismology, which is fascinating, but it's a totally different mechanism. But other than those three bodies, we've not studied other planets through seismic means. And so any assumptions or knowledge we have about the interior of other bodies are due to other kinds of estimates, the most prevalent of which is being moment of inertia measurements, which you can get by measuring the slight wobble in an orbiting satellite around the planet over time.
Well, then but we know that there are earthquakes on, or Mars quakes or things like that. How do we know that?
Well, we think there are for a few reasons. One is with the tremendously high resolution imagery we're getting from some of the recent orbiting cameras around Mars, you can see just within the few years that they're orbiting, changes to the landscape. Changes due to all kinds of things, from wind erosion, for example, but also due to some things like landslides. And at least on the Earth, most landslides are triggered by earthquakes. And so if that's true for Mars as well, then perhaps there are some small quakes going on. Also, there's a lot of evidence for offset faults on Mars, the sorts of things that you expect to occur when a seismic shift occurs on Earth. And so it looks like a lot of these fracture and tectonic features on Mars have been active in a relatively recent past, especially around the Tharsis area, which is where all the volcanoes are, and Ballast Marineris. So that if you want to look for earthquakes on Mars, maybe that's the region you would look.
Does Mars Science Lab have any seismic detectors on it?
It does not. So one of the unfortunate casualties of the follow the water mantra and look for life mantra that NASA has, which is a tremendously laudable goal, is that due to budget constraints and funding constraints and power and mass constraints, geophysical experiments always get left on the drawing board. And there's a I gave a presentation with a colleague from NASA JPL about this a few years ago where there's a history of these sorts of missions getting proposed and going through the process in NASA and then getting pretty far in some cases and then eventually getting chopped or being a payload on a mission and eventually getting left off. It's always the first to go. And one of the reasons is that seismometers, at least, compared with other instruments, are relatively expensive to operate because they require continuous power because you want to record all the time. You never know when the earthquake's going to happen. And they require a lot of bandwidth to transmit that data out. So even if you're smart about compressing it, which you would have to be, it still needs to transmit it out at a higher rate than you do with other sorts of data. So
you also would like to have 203s,
right.
a different location in order to triangulate where the earthquake is actually coming from.
So, Friedman, given that you're looking at these electric waves going up from the surface through the atmosphere into the ionosphere, and on the Moon and Mars, you don't have the atmosphere or an ionosphere equivalent or anything like that. What is can you extrapolate from that at all for your studies or research, or is the Earth just extremely unique and different because we have an atmosphere?
No, one topic that we did not touch upon at all was the infrared emission from the Earth's surface when stresses are building up underground. And likewise, on Mars, we would expect that we would see specific infrared emission from the surface of Mars if stresses are building up. But in order to recognize this infrared emission, one would have to have very capable satellites with infrared cameras, and this is not available. Not yet.
So, in a sense, the study and the research needed and the tools needed kind of take a back seat to a lot of other things in science and exploration, correct?
Yeah, you have to probably balance what is scientifically interesting for the moment, and this may change from year to year, from decade to decade. But like Brian said, for the moment, geophysical measurements on other planets are, because they are so terribly expensive to place and also to run, they have taken a back seat.
You know, I did not know that. I was under the impression that we were collecting geophysical data from Mars and other places in the nearby solar system. Simply not true.
It's not true from the collection side, but it, of course, it's very true that people try to tease out from the satellite images information, indirect information about geophysical data.
Right.
Right. The field of geodynamics is coupled very well to these images, where you take the images and you have a model about what a fault should do, for example, and you can try to correlate that quantitatively to what you're seeing in the images. And it's tremendous science that's been done with that.
Brian, if you were applying for a job with NOAA today and you made your out-of-the-box interest and focus known, would that be a hindrance in getting your job?
Oh, I don't know. but I think, you know, the most important thing for any job, including this one, is you have to be competent and know, you know, your skills and, you know, this, especially an operational job like this that requires public safety, you know, protection measures. So, you know, regardless of what cutting-edge kind of research you may be doing, and many of us here are doing cutting-edge research of one kind or another, you still have to know the basics and stay current on all that. So I look forward to advancements along all these lines that we described today. And, And, you know, I think with time, with incremental changes, and perhaps with some revolutionary changes, if some big breakthroughs occur, we will see a change in 10 to 15 years where some of these things are integrated more into our understanding and operations.
Did we have any advance notice of what was about to unfold in Japan, or was the earthquake and the tsunami, all of that was just came out of the blue and there was no advanced information?
There have been a couple of papers put out about the, I already mentioned the thermal anomaly phenomena that comes from that infrared activity that Freeman mentioned, for example, may be related to ionization if it's under the water. And
radio transmission papers.
Yeah, yes. That's right. So some of these things were there, but it should be noted that these are after the fact, and they're, you know, when I say we, and now I'm putting on my NOAA hat, as far as we're concerned, you know, we don't know about it until it happens. So as soon as it happens, though, within seconds, we're reacting, and we are, you know, we're looking at the data, we're sending out warnings, we're talking on the phone, but prior to that, there's no sort of system set up to monitor this. Now, there are informal systems out there where people are on their own monitoring these radio emissions. For example, someone Friedman knows pretty well, Phil Paulus Watts, does this. There's the Quake Finder Project in certain regions. But those things don't really feed into your major seismic warning system.
Mm-hmm. Not yet.
You didn't have any indications in advance that anything like this was on the way.
There were a lot of, if you plot the earthquakes up leading up to the event, say go a week or two before the event, there is an increase in seismic activity in the region. So those are foreshocks. So that was occurring. And there is a measure that's used in seismology called D-values, which is a quantitative measure of seismic energy released on a fault related to foreshocks or aftershocks. I suppose if one were monitoring that in real time, one could make a conclusion that perhaps energy is building, but it's not something that's usually done. It's usually done after the fact.
After the fact. Now, I remember we were watching it here on cable probably from 8 or 9 o'clock at night till nonstop for weeks. So you in Hawaii are 3 hours earlier than me. So what were you? I'm just curious to know what were you doing at NOAA? Do you have your own sources? Were you watching CNN and seeing what was happening? I mean, what was different about what you had available versus what all of us had around the world?
Well, the center where I work is a nerve center for seismic information and oceanographic information, and so we receive data from hundreds of stations worldwide. These are land stations for both the purposes of seismology and ocean monitoring, ocean sea level monitoring. And so what triggers our alarm bells are seismic waves, because seismic waves travel thousands of times faster than ocean waves, even tsunami waves that are fast. So the first indication of any problem is with a seismic detection. And so when those alarms go off, we start looking at the computers and start analyzing the situation, and we have to estimate the magnitude and the depth of the earthquake, which are critical for determining how threatening it's going to be. And those are very challenging in the first few minutes, because especially for large earthquakes, because they release a lot of their energy in longer periods, which means it takes more minutes to get the energy. But anyway, that's the information we have at our disposal. We don't really turn on the news because it's more of a distraction. But having said that, most of the phone calls we field, and we fielded several thousand during that event, were almost all from the media.
Did you know right away that this was something that was going to be extraordinary?
Oh, yeah. You can tell right away, just when the first wiggles appear on the screen on a seismogram, that it's a major event. So it's clear that these things, although rare, are they happen, and when they happen, you can tell. Now the initial magnitude estimates that we gave, as well as Japan, were low, and that's due to that phenomenon I said of the energy being released in long periods. And in fact, that was perhaps tragically one of the reasons that there were so many deaths in Japan, was was really because the initial warning was their medium-level warning, not their high-level warning. And that was because the earthquake magnitude was initially thought to be lower.
And did you know that this was going to cause a huge tsunami?
Yeah. And we run forecast models right away that forecast what, if you impart energy in the ocean this way, what would be the resulting tsunami. And so we can do that within a few seconds to a few minutes from the earthquake. And then we have an estimate from not only when, but how big the tsunami is going to be. And you know, we can tell right away this is going to be a major local tsunami for Japan, as well as one that crossed the Pacific.
Were you at work when this happened, or did you have to come in?
For me, I was at home. So it occurred about in the evening, and I just put my kids to bed, and then the alarm came off and went off, and then I drove in to work.
So you have an alarm at home?
Sometimes I carry it with me. Yeah.
So you went into work when this happened?
Yeah.
And Friedman, were you in Northern California at the time?
I was in Northern California, and I just heard it. I did not, because I'm not plugged in the
Right, you're more, you know, people started sending me emails, quick, turn on Fox or CNN and see what's happening in Japan.
Yeah.
And it was just unbelievable.
Yeah.
Guys, we're at the end of the program. How about some concluding comments from both of you? Maybe what you want us to take home the most from our discussion tonight, and hopefully we can have more of these down the road. I think this is really a great area of interest that needs a lot more attention, and I think it's also something that should get space people to be talking to the scientists. I personally see commercial opportunities here, just like what you saw at the suborbital conference. I think there are lots of these, maybe even with CubeSats, even though their capabilities are a lot smaller and they're briefer time on orbit, but also you can get a lot of them up and they're cheaper, and maybe they can provide significant data over 3 weeks to 4 weeks or 5 weeks over an area. I definitely think more space people need to understand that these are opportunities for valuable research. Brian, you want to go first and give us some takeaways or closing comments?
Yeah, sure. Thanks for having me on the show, and just wanted to reiterate, these opinions are my own, not Noah's, but I am really encouraged by all of these fascinating discoveries that we've been seeing with the electronic phenomenon emitted by earthquakes and all the various effects that it has throughout the atmosphere that Friedman described. And I think there is mounting evidence that these things are real, first of all, and that they can reliably predict at least major earthquakes by a week or two, which is huge news for saving lives and potentially. I think the resources of space can be put to bear on the problem in a number of ways, because, as we said, the research satellites that are up there now, like Demeter, only limited. They're only one satellite in that case, for example. It's not enough to monitor the whole Earth. There are companies like Iridium, for example, which is a major communication company that have constellations of satellites. And with a constellation, you can monitor the whole planet. The Iridium Next constellation, which they've been working on, that's going to replace the existing one, it has as part of its payload this philanthropic part of it, where they'll fly scientific payloads for free for advancing knowledge and research. And one of their stated goals is natural hazard mitigation. And so one would think that there would be a natural partnership with some of these commercial satellite providers, like you mentioned, David. And so I'd like to see that over time happening. But first, we have to develop the technology to measure these things, which is relatively straightforward, I think. And so what we hope to do on these suborbital missions is demonstrate the technology, show that it can measure what we want it to measure, work out any bugs with it. And I would like to see these sorts of instruments become perhaps standard payloads or devices that are on suborbital vehicles as well as orbiting satellites, because the more platforms, the better for detecting these. I know that my organization, NOAA, does have an MOU with Virgin Galactic, for example, and that MOU is for measuring carbon dioxide and greenhouse gases from Virgin Galactic's Spaceship Two fleet that they're developing. And so there is a precedent for for the government working with some of these companies. So that's my excitement with this. And, of course, I would like to see people involved at all phases of the project, from the mission side, as the planning side. And, you know, if you need an astronaut in the loop, then the astronaut can help. But, but the ground stations, like what QuakeFinder is doing, are really important, I think, for closing the loop on understanding this.
Friedman, do you have some takeaways for us and closing comments?
Yeah, I do want to stress again that I'm really an outsider who came to this area from completely unprepared from basic research, and then it so happened that I had made inadvertently a fundamental discovery, namely these electrically active defects in minerals that seem to be dominating this entire scenario of pre-earthquake signals from what we can measure on the ground and from satellite. And it now looks that the work that I was happy to or lucky to do is providing us a comprehensive picture of how the different phenomena are connected, starting from animal behavior to ionospheric perturbation, something that many people have said it cannot be connected. There is no mechanism by which you can connect it. And then my work shows that, no, there is a mechanism. The mechanism is this activation of these electrically active charge carriers in the Earth's crust and all the sequence of other processes that happen at the ground-air-ground-water interface and through the atmospheric column all the way up to the ionosphere. So I'm very hopeful, and I think that the mainstream geophysics community, seismology in particular, will come around and recognize that there's something new to think about. There is a shift in paradigm, and that will bring a change to the better.
Gentlemen, fascinating, and I want to thank you both for being here. And please do keep me in the loop on new work, new issues, new things that come up. And I'm perfectly fine doing more programming on this. As I said, I think it's really important. I think it's a good bridge for commercial space and opportunities into much-needed science. And if the space show can play a part in getting it out there to the public and maybe getting some interest in it, so be it. I think it's worthwhile. So I want to thank you both for being here tonight and for helping us to understand some things that are pretty complex about the Earth and the solar system and where we live and what we can do with it and how we can maybe change it for the better in the future. So Friedman and Brian, thanks again for being here, and my best to you for the rest of the week, and I hope we do this again down the road.
Okay, thank you, David.
Thank you, and Brian as well, and I hope to see you guys soon at a conference or someplace in the near future. And thank you again, both of you, for being the guests on the Space Show tonight. And listeners, this takes us to our next Space Show program, which is Friday morning of this week, 9:30 a.m. California time. Thank you all, and goodbye from the Space Show.